Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of What the How? You know, after all the fires we've had around here, some people may be scratching their heads and going, what the how? I mean, you know, the fires are so bad this year. And a lot of that is because we're told climate change. A lot of that is because we're told an overgrowth of brush. A lot of that is we're told because we don't have a lot of rain. And so until we get a lot of rain and that gets moisture into the ground fuel, we may be still in a pickle for a while. And joining us right now is Chief Ralph Terrazas, who's been L.A.'s fire chief since 2014. He is a 35-year veteran. 35 years. How do you do that when you're only 36?
I wish. Thank you for having me. And we've had an incredible brush season so far, and we're not done. The projection is for the rest of the year to have minimal rain. Our fuel is ready to burn, and we'll have about 10 Santa Ana wind condition days, red flag days, in the month of November, December, and January.
Can you explain to people that might be in other parts of the country or even the world what it is about Southern California and why we have the kind of wildfires we do?
Well, these fires are historical. They've been burning for thousands of years. They come when the Santa Anas kick in. It's a natural pathway to the Pacific Ocean. And when we look at our historical burn patterns, we see the burns of the large fires typically follow the Santa Ana wind conditions.
And that's kind of a good thing and kind of a bad thing. It's good because you know where it goes. It's bad because there are a lot of houses in the way.
Absolutely. With the development that's gone on over the last several years, we have more homes that are in the brush interface. And that's made our job a little more difficult because we have to get there quicker. If we don't, we lose more houses. Back in the day, there wasn't a lot of houses to lose, but now there are.
But, you know, I think there was one fire where a concrete house stayed. We just can't all build our houses out of concrete.
True. We are looking at hardening houses, construction. The L.A. Fire Department and L.A. Building Safety are working together. After the Getty Fire, I noticed some things that I'd like to take a look at.
Like what?
Well, boxed-in eaves, number one. Perhaps we should have a higher fire rating on the exterior walls of these structures.
In other words, they have a bigger pain threshold?
It'll take more for them to start a fire,
right?
Which buys us time. You add the 200-foot minimum clearance, that's defensible space. You add the hardened house, that gives us a little more time to get there in front of the fire to protect that home.
The hardening of homes, and we've actually done a podcast on that, the hardening of the homes, that can be done right from the very beginning, right from the very beginning of construction. Don't build it out of wood.
True. If you look at some of the houses that survived the Woolsey Fire, the one in Malibu last year, those that survived, concrete construction, double pane windows, boxed in eaves, built low to the ground with a lot of fire resistive vegetation surrounding it.
Do you get a little anxious when you know the winds are going to kick up and we're going to have red flag weather?
I do a little bit. I'm more concerned. I'm watching my phone more closely. I'm watching the weather reports. I do get alerted on any significant fire on my phone. When we're in those red flag days, I'm paying extra special attention to ensure that we're ready for the next challenge.
You know, it was something that the chief and I talked about earlier, which I thought was interesting, was that he's as savvy with a smartphone as you and I might be. And where you and I might call a family member when we hear about a fire, he calls other fire chiefs. Tell us about that.
Well, we have to use modern technology, and texting isn't that new anymore. What's new is that on a string, I have three other fire chiefs in this region, from Orange County, from LA County, and Ventura County. So if we see a big fire coming, we'll notify them. We'll send a projection using our Wi-Fi projection, and we'll send some resources. So in the recent fire in Ventura, the EZ fire, we had six strike teams and a helicopter within minutes of that fire breaking out.
And that wasn't far from my home either. The Saddle Ridge fire, I live in Simi Valley, so so the Saddle Ridge fire came from the east toward my house and got fortunately cut off by firefighter air support. And the Easy Fire was in the eastern part, in the western part of Simi Valley, to the west of my house. I feel like I've been surrounded by fire this year.
Well, hell, you know, I don't know what to say. Southern California, that's one of the challenges that comes with living here. The Easy Fire, I believe that's the fire where the Reagan Library was threatened. And that fire literally burned up to the edge of that structure at the Reagan Library.
Interesting thing about the Reagan Library is every year they bring in hundreds of goats, and the goats eat up the grass, and they have usually a news conference to talk to everybody about fire clearing your grass and suppression and all that. And so those goats are really kind of fun to watch.
It is a known method of removing brush.
Yeah, and they eat it.
By my house, I've seen the same thing. Herds of the goats and sheep out there eating the brush. However you do it, it's important that you do it. We send out a mailer in April, and in May 1st, we do a brush sweep. That's where our firefighters visually inspect the property and ensure that it's clear. And this year, we have 140,000 parcels to inspect. In our first sweep, we had 92% compliance.
That sounds like it takes a lot of personnel.
It does. It's very expensive, too. But it's very worth the effort.
Yeah, because when you have a fire, you know that you're going to have defensible space.
Yes.
And that's the important part. There's a lot of technology you're using now that you didn't used to use. I guess in the 35 years you've been doing this, a lot has changed technologically. Some of the biggest advancements in air support?
Absolutely. The helicopters are a huge game changer for us. We now have drones that we use as well. The technology to project where a brush fire is going to burn, that's based on real-time weather data. We can run that projection within the first few minutes of a brush fire. This year, for the first time, we have fixed-wing assets that can fly the perimeter of the fire. That further validates the path of the fire and the need to evacuate.
So Cal Fire is getting some new air equipment. They're getting some C-130s. I forget whether it's 10 or 12 or something like that. They're getting some new, I think they're kind of like Blackhawks, Firehawks. And also I think Ventura County is getting a couple of new helicopters, but not L.A. City.
Well, we have we recently acquired two new helicopters in the last 2 years. The one we most recently got was just a few months ago. Those are $18.5 million each. We do have five Augusta AW139s and two Bell Jet Rangers. On top of
what do they hold? What do they hold?
They hold 450 gallons of water per drop. On top of that, we lease the Ericsson air crane. We lease that for 4 months. And we have it now through the end of the year. That drops 2,600 gallons of water.
That's that thing you see in the sky that looks like it's got a big hose coming down.
Yes.
And so when that drops down over a reservoir or someplace where it can get water, the hose goes in, it sucks up the water, and then they take off and drop it somewhere else.
Yeah, they call that snorkeling, and they do that. Also, our helicopters will do that as well. I was flying with a pilot at one of the recent fires, and he told me he'd made 47 drops the day before.
Yeah.
So that tells you how effective they are.
Well, that Saddle Ridge fire, I'm not sure they would have stopped it if it hadn't been for air support, because they laid down a line of FOSCHECK. It was early morning, so the winds had just slightly changed some. They dropped water on it, and I was saying, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, because my house was still standing, but a lot of others weren't, and that was tragic.
They do amazing work. We did lose a few homes. The loss could have been a lot greater. No lives were lost, most importantly. We can replace a house, can't we replace a person? So we're very fortunate. We're not through with the season yet. The rain is going to help that we're getting today. But it's only going to last a few weeks before it dries out again.
You know, there was a time we had 7 years of drought. And then there was a time that I kind of thought we were starting to get rain again. And so we were talking about El Nino, and we were all, and it was starting to look like, hey, we're going to get back in the weather game again, and we're going to get some rain, and that's going to be great. And then it kind of went away. It rains, but it doesn't rain that much.
Yeah. No, I was excited, too.
Yeah.
I thought that's going to be good. Earlier this year, there was a lot of rain,
yeah,
and there was a lot of new grasses.
Yeah.
Then I started thinking, well, they're going to dry out eventually, and they become fuel. So it's good and bad. You need sustained rain, mm-hmm, not just a lot at once and not have rain for a long period of time, because it becomes fuel.
But we get unintended consequences.
Mm-hmm.
We have fires, and then the rain comes, and then we have mudslides.
Yes.
And it's like one disaster after another when these sort of things happen that way. Now, if you remember last year, the fire that went down into Malibu, that caused a lot of, say, Malibu Canyon, for instance, that caused a lot of burn damage. When the rains came, mudslides.
Well, the same thing in Montecito.
Yeah.
You know, several people lost their lives after the Thomas Fire.
Yeah.
The with rain, it's a different type of call load. We get 10% more runs on a rainy day when it's a half inch or more.
Is that car wrecks?
It's traffic accidents. It's automatic alarms. It's down wires. We even get people into the flood channels that cause another incident for us. And that's a heavy commitment of resources, but we have to do it.
You used to be a firefighter on the street, just like at a firehouse. What did you learn when you were on the street that you carried into the chief's office? What did people tell you?
Well, I know that the number one concern I have is the safety and well-being of our firefighters. I know the risks that they face every day.
Because you did.
I did, and my son's a firefighter now. And the number one threat to the health and safety of professional firefighters today is cancer. Another big threat is PTSD and firefighter suicide. Last calendar year, we lost more firefighters across the country from suicide than we did line-of-duty deaths. So the Los Angeles City Fire Department is taking on a lot of initiatives to address those two main things. We're doing cancer prevention, policy changes. We've hired fire psychologists. We're always looking at ourselves in a critical manner and how we can do things better, faster, and safer on the scene of a fire.
Cancer. Is that because of being out in toxic materials?
It's the carcinogens that are created when fuel burns. And with all the modern materials now, the synthetics and plastics that are in home construction as well as cars, our firefighters are exposed to that. So we have a new policy that the incident commander, at their discretion, if they feel that their people are contaminated to the point they need immediately to shower and clean their turnouts, they're allowed to stay out of service until they get that done.
When did that start?
In August of this year.
And has there been a situation where that had to be done?
We're doing that now on a regular basis. It's not as frequent as you would think. Not the entire first alarm assignment. It's usually just the initial fire attack and the backup fire attack, because when they go inside a structure, they're the ones that get exposed to the most types of smoke and heavy particulates.
You know, I've thought about that myself, because as a reporter, we end up in the same place as you do, and we get that same smoke that you do, and we deal with the same issues that you do. And so we try to wear masks.
Yes.
And I think they're N9 masks.
N95 is usually the one.
N95 masks, yeah. And, but that didn't used to be the case. You know,
no.
It kind of over the years, we've all learned how to be safe for ourselves.
Well, you know, back in the day, myself included, we had one set of turnouts. Now we have two sets. And then that was because we wanted the ability to clean one and to wear the other one. Our busy assignment, sometimes we'll have more than two fires on the same day. You just have to keep washing them.
So for the sake of clarification, turnouts are the yellow jackets and pants that the firefighters wear. And I have a set of that myself.
Yes.
And it's made of Nomex, which is a material that doesn't burn. And so that's why you see everybody wearing that when they're at fires. So I was at the cleaners right after one of those fires recently. And I said, how long would it take to get my turnouts clean? Because I you know, it smells so bad. You know, my wife makes me take off my clothes a block down the street before I get in the house. And I'm kidding. And he said, well, it's going to take a couple of days because we have to do this, we have to do that. And I thought, you know what? With the frequency of fires, there's no time.
You're absolutely right. You know, and not only your turnout gear, but your body smells like smoke for a couple of days. It doesn't, even after you take a shower, you still smell the smoke. My wife still smells the smoke.
Yeah.
So that just tells me that, you know, we're contaminating our people, and we need to be very vigilant in making sure that they shower right after a fire and they clean their gear so that they can minimize the exposure to carcinogens.
It's great to hear you talking about that, because the health risks are pretty high. You know, there was a time when the Orange County Fire Authority wanted to show me what it was like to be out there fighting fires in 100-plus degree heat. And so they put me in turnouts. They put me in heavy gear, and they showed me how to set backfires, and we all worked our way up the hill, setting backfires or coming down the hill, whatever way that was. Literally a matter of minutes, I was so dehydrated. I couldn't even get over it. The water just poured out of me. And I couldn't get enough water, bottled water, to drink it back up again. It was just the heat, the flames, which are incredibly hot, and the water just poured out. And firefighters have to deal with that too.
Absolutely. Hydration is the key. We do have specialized gear for brush firefighting, different from structural firefighting. It's lighter. Mm-hmm. It breathes more. We're conscious about that threat. We try to rotate our people when we can. But some of these large fires that are fast moving, they may be on the line for 24 to 36 hours straight. And that's just when you take that oath, that's part of the deal when you're protecting lives and property.
Well, and part of that is that you'll bring in mutual aid on a fire big enough. And when you bring in the mutual aid, first your first line of attack are your people and as many of them as you can throw at it. And then after, say, 24 hours, they'll come offline, go into the base camp, catch some sleep while the fresh troops come in and start picking it up.
That's true, and unless there's simultaneous large incidents. We had that happen in 2017. There was the Thomas Fire in Ventura, the Creek Fire. That was on a Monday. The Creek Fire in the San Fernando Valley on Tuesday, and the Screwball Fire on Wednesday. These are three consecutive days. Thomas Fire was in Ventura, but we sent people there. We were stretched thin. We tried to give our people rest periods, but sometimes you don't have the luxury of time, and you have to just commit.
You know, you get some of, and I've talked with firefighters about this before, you get something kind of like firefighter fatigue. And so how can you tell when firefighter fatigue is sort of set in? And how do you know, as a battalion chief, let's say, when you got to pull them out of service for their own safety?
Well, I think it's the supervisor, the battalion chief and the captains, you have to be watching continuously. And you're walking the line. You need to watch the activities and see what they're doing. Some assignments are more strenuous than others. Then you just have to use a good decision-making to give them rest when you can. Sometimes it's a matter of just take an hour, go ahead and sleep on your rig. If we need you, we'll call you. After the initial spike of the fire activity, there is a chance to get them some rest. And we mandate a minimum of 12 hours rest period when we can do that.
Drones. We should probably talk about drones because, first of all, a lot of people will get them for Christmas gifts.
Yes.
And as they do, they're going to take them and they're going to want to fly them and they'll have cameras and then it comes a fire and they're going to want to get images of the fire
right.
And then they're in trouble.
Right.
Right? Tell them about the problems associated with that.
Well, if a drone can take down a helicopter, a drone strike can take down a helicopter if it hits it in the
Is that like a bird strike?
Same thing.
Yeah.
And you're right about Christmas toys. Last Christmas, the number one gift was drones. That causes me some concern because it affects the safety of our pilots. So whenever a drone is up in the air with our helicopters, if it's a civilian drone, unauthorized, we have to ground our helicopters. They can't fly. If they're grounded, the fire is continuing to burn and move. So it's really a detriment to our challenge, and we highly emphasize no drones are allowed.
Now, the drones that are allowed are the nine that you own.
Yes.
As a fire department. Tell us about those.
2 years ago at the Screwball Fire, we introduced the drones for the first time. We used them with an infrared camera attached to the drone. So they're able to fly the brush area after we knocked down the bulk of the fire to find hot spots. We used to use our helicopter for that purpose, but this is much better. The helicopter doing it, it's risky, it's burning fuel, and the motor is accumulating hours. Once it hits 100 hours, it has to go in for maintenance, and we lose it for 2 days.
There's a cost per hour, too. It's
Absolutely. Exorbitant.
Yeah,
we calculated that around $7,000 an hour.
An hour.
The drone, much cheaper. The helicopter is $18.5 million to buy. The drone is a couple thousand. The drone can fly forever. There is no downside to using the drone, only upside.
So as you take a drone and you move it over a fire area, fire looks like it's out, but you've got an infrared on it, and all of a sudden you look down and in the ash you see some orange, and that orange is active fire that's maybe covered over by mm-hmm. other ash and things, and so that could start another fire with just a good whip of wind.
Absolutely. That's our concern after these big fires. We're still on scene for a few days after the majority of the fire's out. It's for that very reason that maybe we missed a hot spot. So we have patrols that will continue for a couple of days. We use the infrared images to identify the locations where we need to go. And then the firefighters go out there and extinguish the fire.
How much trouble do you have telling people to leave the neighborhoods?
You know, we didn't have very, very many issues with that in the recent fires. LAPD, that's their task, is to do the evacuations. The people that are closest to the fire, sometimes it's better to shelter in place. Sometimes, most of the time we'll do that in the early phases because if they try to get out while we're trying to get in, we're going to have a traffic jam and we're not going to be able to get in front of that fire. But the people that are further downwind of the fire, there's the ability to get out, and LAPD takes on that task. The last time on the Getty fire, we had 2.5 million hits on our web page, lafd.org. They went to look at the evacuation map. So I was very happy to see that the public is getting notified and they're accessing that information.
What do you think about that? 2.5 million.
I think that's incredible. We learned in the 2017 fires up in the wine country, Santa Rosa fire, that people need to know. People died in those fires, and no alerting occurred. And I made a mental decision back then that if that happened here, we're going to alert early and often. I want to give people a chance. And the difference, too, is that our department, we're more densely populated with firefighters and fire stations. We'll get on scene in about 5 minutes. It's different in Northern California. The thing that's same to me, is the same to me is the advance warning that we can give to the public. And why not? So I'm a firm believer of alerting. People can notify. In L.A., we have a Notify L.A. system. You can join that system by texting the word READY to 888-777.
And every county in the area, or probably even where you live if you're not here in California, because with podcasting, we're everywhere, right? You probably have a similar sort of thing with your fire department, and you should check with them or look them up online, and you'll probably see there's some kind of an alert system because it's very common now to do that. There was also the reverse 911 calls, and you still do that, right?
LAPD will do that for us. And on top of both of those two systems is the wireless emergency alert system. That's the alert that you get on your cell phone. You don't have to register for that. If you're in the impacted area, you will get that alert.
Automatically.
Is that
by GPS? Is that how that...
It's by GPS. We call, we put down a geofence over a map. In the city of LA, it's the emergency management department who's tasked with that responsibility. It's the fire department's task to tell the emergency management department when to send it and which area is impacted.
And so by putting that fence over this map, anything inside that fence is going to get alerted.
Any cell phone will get alerted.
It
comes across like an amber alert.
Right, and an amber alert can be very loud.
Yes, when we want it to be.
Yeah, well, you want people's attention. So as you're doing that, there are people that still will ignore mandatory evacuation orders. And what I've seen over the years in talking to some of those people who are standing there with hoses in front of their house and on top of their houses is that I'm going to save my house. I don't know when the fire department's going to get here. I'm going to save my house because the fire's coming. And then recently, and I've shared this story with you, there was a man in Agoura Hills whose home was damaged by the Woolsey fire. He got up on the roof. He had a hose. He's starting to do the whole hose the roof thing. All of a sudden, the flames start getting close, and he feels the heat. And that heat can get up to what kind of a temperature range?
Well, interior in a house, it's over 1,000 degrees.
But is it coming to you from, say, down the street?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but it's hot.
It's hot.
Really hot.
I've felt that. So that heat comes towards you. He's on the roof, and he goes to himself. He says, and this is a quote from him, "I think this is probably a bad idea."
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to the back part of the roof, and he crouches down, and he hides on the back part of the roof because he thinks that's going to protect him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it did in that case, but it might have been a different story. Could have been.
Right.
It depends on what that fire did and how much of that house has started to consume. And the roof, unless you're a good jumper, is not a great place to be in that situation.
Yeah, well, I don't advocate that people stay and try to defend their house. Let the professionals do that.
Have you seen a lot of people get hurt by doing that?
Well, what it does is distract from our firefighting effort to go perform a rescue instead. And then we've been fortunate. We've pulled people out of harm's way. Yeah. I remember the Latuna fire. We had somebody who refused to leave. And we had to divert our helicopters to make water drops around that house because that person wasn't leaving. In the meantime, the fire was getting ahead of steam in an area that we didn't want it to. So it really impacted our firefighting efforts in that case.
Yeah, I mean that's really a serious issue. And you know, people depend on the fire department to come save my house, and you've got to help out too. And what kinds of things can people do to help you in dealing with saving their house?
Well, in the city of LA, you have to have 200-foot minimum clearance between brush and your house. It's different in whatever part of the state you live in, but for the city of LA, it's 200 feet. We also need you to be aware of the Ready, Set, Go program. You can get information on brush clearance and the Ready, Set, Go program by going to our website at lafd.org. And the way you clear brush, too, we have very good pictures on the website about how you should clear your shrubs and your trees. All the tips that we can share with you, we'd like you to pay attention and to apply those tips to your house.
It's interesting because we tend to clump things into three words now. So you got ready, set, go. And then if, God forbid, you had some kind of a school attack or a workplace mass casualty, it's run, hide, fight.
Right.
And in that case, like when we recently saw the Saugus High School shooting, the LA County Fire Department sent 24 ambulances plus paramedics out to that school. Within a couple of minutes, they were ready to do the job that needed to be done. There was one situation where somebody was airlifted, a student was airlifted to Holy Cross Hospital. If a shooting like that were to occur in the city of LA, how would the LA Fire Department respond?
Very similar. We would establish a unified command with LAPD, and we'd marry up our paramedics with the police officers and make entry into the warm zone and to extract patients and treat them.
Warm zone?
Warm zone is, the hot zone is where the shooter is. The warm zone is a little bit further away. Our paramedics will have force protection is what we call it. Police officers with their guns drawn, protecting them while they're treating patients. During the Getty fire, we had 17 rescues where elderly people needed to be evacuated because they couldn't get out on their own. So we had to dedicate 17 ambulances to perform that function, and they did it. That's part of our mission. The world we live in today, we do have active shooters. We have bomb threats. We have earthquakes, brush fires, mudslides. It's never ending, especially here in Southern California.
So as we talk about that, one of the things I think is very exciting that you think is very exciting is telemedicine. And that's kind of the next thing on the horizon, right?
That's the next big thing. I consider it a game changer for us. Low-level medical calls, 88% of all our calls are EMS, emergency medical services. We average 1,350 calls a day, and we transport over 600 people to the hospital per day. So the old answer to the increasing call load was to keep adding ambulances. Well, we're looking at it from a different way now. We need to manage our call load differently, be smarter. So what telemedicine is for low-level calls, we'll still dispatch an ambulance. We'll do a patient assessment. The medics on scene will do that. And then we'll Skype the patient's picture and image to the doctor who is going to be at our dispatch center. The doctor will make the determination, do we transport or not? We believe that we can reduce some of our call load, hopefully in the range of 2%, which is a lot of runs.
What kind of calls would work for that as opposed to I got to be there at the scene because I might have to pump this guy's heart?
Well, a low-level call could be anything from my back's been hurting for a month, I strained my shoulder, contrasted to I'm having chest pain. That's not an option when you're having chest pain. Everybody's going and we're probably going to transport. But these low-level calls truly are not life-threatening emergencies.
This you said it was a game changer. Is it being done elsewhere, or is this something we're kind of leading the way?
Well, I'd like to take credit for being the first, but Houston Fire Department actually has pioneered it. And I went to Houston last year with my medical director, and we saw how it worked. And we've taken the components of that we like and adding on to it. We're very excited about the potential of this project. This has been funded already through Mayor Garcetti's Innovation Fund. We believe that we're going to reduce call load, we're going to get the patients the proper care, and we're going to relieve some of the high call load activity from 911.
So if you were to try to frame it in a win-win, you guys win because you don't have to use as many people, which means there are more people to do other things when needed. The patient wins because they're going to get quicker care. It might be through Skype, But if it's a low-level situation, that could be as good as being there.
And I would add, insurance companies win too. Because if we transport, you're going to get a bill for $1,500. If we transport to an out-of-network hospital, that bill is about $2,500. So that's $4,000. But if, for example, you're a Kaiser patient, we navigate you to a Kaiser clinic, you're going to save $4,000 from the insurance company. So there's a financial incentive for them to participate. And we're negotiating with Kaiser right now about a navigation fee.
So if I had magical powers, number one, I'd be your superhero. But if I did have magical powers,
okay,
what would you want? What would you want for the department?
Well,
cost isn't an issue.
We have a fantastic department. What I'd like to see in the region is an infrastructure of hospital and specialty center destinations that we can transport patients to. For example, we have a sober unit that's specific to Skid Row. We can transport to sober centers, and there's a sober center in Skid Row, but that's the only one. We have the entire city of L.A. The other thing is a mental health clinic. So there's three primary places that we can transport to, we'd like to transport to. Emergency rooms, those are overcrowding. We're sending too many low-level calls. Sober centers, those are great. There's not enough. Mental health centers, those are great. There's not enough. So I'm working with the county to try to build that infrastructure.
Sober centers would be for people that are inebriated?
Inebriated, and we've eliminated any other physical possibility, any physical cause. They're not sick. They're not injured. They're just inebriated.
How many of those incidents do you have to deal with?
We have a large number. We get stats on a weekly basis, and we transport to the sober center on average, I'd say 10 to 12 times per day, just in that one district.
In Skid Row.
Yep.
And with regard to mental health, that's always a tough situation.
Yes.
What are you seeing there?
Well, when we take a mental health patient to an emergency room that's not certified for mental health care, they stay there and occupy a bed for days and don't get the care they need. If you have a mental health center clinic, and there is such a thing, there's one near County USC, and there's one at all of you, you can get in and out in less than 30 minutes with our paramedics. The patient gets to be seen by mental health professionals right away. So in that case, the patient wins, the system wins, our paramedics win because they get released and they're available for another call.
Unfortunately, I said cost was no issue, but I gather cost is an issue, and that's why we're not seeing a network of these sort of things.
It's a tremendous cost to do this, but I'm working with the county, and we're on a monthly basis. We just started pointing out some issues that we would like to see addressed.
So, yeah. What would you like to tell people out there about, you know, just what you do and how you feel about the community?
Well, number one, I am tremendously proud to be part of the Los Angeles City Fire Department for the past 36 years. When I encounter our firefighters and I drop in a fire station, I ask them how they're doing, and I hear they're living the dream. And I feel the same way. My dream has lasted for about 36 years. I want the community to know that you have dedicated professionals, firefighters and paramedics. And whatever the challenge is that occurs before us, whether it's a brush fire, a medical call, an earthquake, we're going to be there. And we're going to be there fast. And we're going to make your situation better. I'm proud of that. I'm proud of our people. And I'm proud of the support that Mayor Garcetti is giving us, the City Council, and the people of Los Angeles have given us.
Chief, thank you. Appreciate it, and thanks for joining us for this episode of What the Hal. And if you haven't subscribed, please do. You can do that at any of the places where you get podcasts or even at whatthehalpodcast.com. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.